My name is Paul Olson. This session is on great scenes from great literature. And tonight we're going to discuss Alice Walker's The Color Purple, and the theme is The Price of Redemption. And I've always been very honest, and I'm going to be honest with you tonight. I prepared like crazy to have all my pages down and just what I'd refer to, and I have frantically searched for 20 minutes and can't find any of it. Oh. So, class dismissed. How can I do it without? We can do it with your help. How many people have read The Color Purple? Ooh, that's great. How many of you liked it? That's great too. Find my notes? No, my wife was looking at the last minute. The reason, were some of you here at 4 o'clock? The reason I wasn't here, I want to explain that. I was fishing with Rudy Edmond. We caught 40 trout. And on the way back, three bears attacked us. And that didn't bother me, but when that dinosaur came, I knew I was going to be late. Well, that's right. The first part was true. I think that for a white person to teach black literature, there's only one approach to take, and that's a radical approach. And as we begin to look at The Color Purple, I'll explain to you what I mean by radical. I'm not going to burn anybody's administration building. But I am going to suggest that there are different ways to read literature, and that what we've been brought up, most of us, and I especially, just gone through the system with higher education through America, on what has traditionally been white critics and white authors. And by way of introduction to The Color Purple and a critical analysis method, I'd like to explain to you, or just relate to you, that I had finished my master's degree. My undergraduate degree was from a good college in the Midwest. My master's degree was from a fine university in the West. And I was done with those two degrees, with a master's degree in American and English literature, and I had never read a black author. Never. So our educational system said to me, hey, you're one of the top 2% educated people in America, and it's okay. I mean, you're the kind of, let's say, the expert on literature, and it's okay that you haven't read a black author. Well, my life was changed by Richard Wright when I read Uncle Tom's Children. And ever since then, black literature has been a real special thing to me. Well, that's one thing about an introduction to this idea of what's radical. And radical in the sense that the institutional structure of what good literature is, you can see, has to be changed. If you can get a master's degree and you've got the stamp of approval, you're okay, and you're educated, and you're ready to go out and teach American youth, and you don't have to have read a black author. Well, something's wrong there. Well, I'd like to have you a little exercise, too. If you could do this on paper, and if you've seen this before, then just sit tight. If you haven't, just for a moment, imagine a way to connect those nine dots. Have you seen this before?
Yeah.
A lot of you have? Well, it still illustrates my point. The way to connect those dots by using four straight lines and never lift your pencil off the paper. It's tough to do. And I do this a lot in black literature classes at home, and I'll see kids, they're going there, and they'll spend 5 minutes on it, and finally they just give up and they can't do it. And what we always end up doing, and those of you who have seen it, 2, 3, 4. But to do that, we had to see something outside of our normal perspective, and outside of the boundaries that we normally give to ourselves. And I think black literature, reading black literature, if you're white, is seeing things in a different way. And being willing to open your mind and your heart, because literature speaks, first of all, I hope, to our heart. To being willing to open that to, oh, there's a different way to perceive things. I have with me, and this is where I'll beg your patience with me, a piece of literary criticism. It's called Alice Walker, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens by Brian Murray. And Brian Murray, this was found in Chronicles of Culture. This might give you a little clue. A periodical printed in Rockford, Illinois. The clue is that the stance is very, very conservative. But the stance is also typical white literary establishment toward literature. Maybe not typical. That's typical philosophy, but particularly bad writing, perhaps. But here's where I want to beg your patience. I had it just exactly where I wanted to read to you from this to suggest a typical literary critic's vision within this circle and unable to see anywhere else. And before I do that, though, I would congratulate those of you who like The Color Purple because you're a better reader than is Brian Murray, who is a doctor of English, which already is a check against him, at Youngstown State University in New York. Youngstown, where's Youngstown?
Ohio.
That's part of it, too. I'm just kidding. Ohio folks. You liked it. And the last step about that, before I look at this typical visionless literary criticism, is that you are beyond that. And I'll relate kind of an anecdotal kind of literary criticism. When The Color Purple first came out, I got it right away because I heard it was good. And I had it on my desk, and my mother-in-law, 70 years old, Norwegian, full-blooded, grew up in Rockford, Illinois. I I think has voted for every Republican that's ever come down the pipe. And that's okay. But she saw The Color Purple on my desk and said, can I read it? And I went, ooh. Tape, that was a swallow. Sure, you can read it. You can't tell her, like, no, you can't read it. I'm teaching it. You know, I couldn't say that. So she read it, and she was about 50 pages into it. And said, how do you like it? Fine. How far are you? Well, I'm about 50 pages. Oh, she isn't to the juicy parts yet. A couple days later, how do you like The Color Purple? Oh, I really like it. You do? How far are you? I'm done. What is it about your ability to suspend judgment of all the interrelationships that are in this novel that perhaps you wouldn't approve of if it was your son or daughter? Would you? I mean, Shug and Seeley just kind of share this guy, and at the same time sometimes, can I sleep with you tonight? And there's a homosexual relationship going on there. My mother-in-law suspended her judgment of all that. That's really good, Paul. Well, before we even get into literary criticism, you are already into it. You already know how to do it. And I suggested when we looked at Salinger last week sometime, and I don't know if any of you were here then or not, I gave this comment about literary criticism. Literary criticism is consciousness after experience. Well, really, that's life. We have an experience, and then we talk to our loved ones, or we sit back and, now, what really happened there? What did he really say? What did she really do? What? And we try to analyze that. And listen to the line again. I wish it were mine. It's not. Literary criticism is consciousness after experience. What we'll do tonight is try to explore the experience that you have already had with Color Purple, or that we will share tonight with just a few pages, and see why that is. And it has something to do with, and the title of this whole presentation is, The Price of Redemption. And what I'm going to suggest is that part of the price we pay as literary critics, and now I'm talking about everyday life, not the kind of literary criticism that an English teacher does, but the kind that you did when you read, and the kind that you do when you analyze an experience. that the price of redemption has something to do with being able to see outside of our normal limited vision and admit another way to live, and in this novel, and another way to love, and what that all means, and how in the end you come away from a book that I suspect that most of you would give not much approval to the moral behavior there. I mean, Shug said what? We fuck so much that we did it right out in the open, and Daddy said not. I mean, that's how it talks. And my mother-in-law said it was good. Something happened in the novel that she could suspend, I love that phrase, her judgment of the book. Well, here's typical judgment. And again, I'm sorry about my pages. I will search Holden Village over and over. Alice Walker, not yet 40, has been publishing poetry and prose since the late 1960s. But only in recent years has her work been accorded the sort of fervid critical praise that the American literary establishment prefers to bestow on certifiable major American writers. We can skip all that. Praise for Walker's 1982 novel, The Color Purple, was widespread and effusive. The New York Times Book Review called it indelibly affecting. The Nation said it placed Walker in the company of Faulkner. And that ain't bad company, if you know that. The San Francisco Chronicle proposed that, in fact, it placed her in the company of Homer, Shakespeare, and Dostoevsky. Now that's really good company. For this was a book good enough to stand beside the literature of any time and place. Steinem, again, concurred. She said, The Color Purple was full of complicated family relationships that no, quote, Russian novel could beat, as well as, quote, succinct, profound discussions about the existence of God. We'll start there. I'll erase. One of his, Brian Murray's, that is, I'm not going to mention that name again because I don't want you to remember it, is that it's a succinct, is that right? Succinct, oh, where's the word here? Profound discussion of God. Okay. It was, she sighed, irresistible to read. To bring things, now watch his rhetoric too, and this isn't my point. This guy's a bad critic, and you know where I stand from the start. But he uses the kind of loaded rhetoric that makes you get down on the book right away. For instance, to bring things to a less ethereal level. Now I'm going to get you down there, okay. It must be admitted that Ms. Walker's novels and short stories prove that she has an eye for interesting detail and an ear for the varied patterns of speech. Whoopee. If any of you were in discussions we had on the earlier sections of literature, I suggested some ways to decide whether literature is good or bad or great. And in a word, one of the things that differentiates good from great literature is the depth of the understanding of the human experience. For instance, if it's a social tract and it talks about the social role of a man or woman in her society, I think then that literature is taken on one level, but it'll never last beyond the times when that black or white or man or woman or whatever is treated a certain way in a society, if it's only a social tract kind of thing, or if it's a religious tract, or if it's a political tract, or not or not. The best literature deals with the toughest questions we ask. If you were here for discussing Barabbas, that's the best. I mean, one of the best. Is there a God? What's it, he, she, like? What's my relationship to it? Why do I die? The biggest questions we ask, the great literary artists deal with. Not just, hey, Sinclair Lewis's the Jungle, or Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, I mean. It's a fine book about oppressive American capitalism. But I don't think it's going to make it great, because it stops there. Well, this book is even less than that. It just has good detail and varied patterns of speech. More often than not, they display a prose style that is polished and graceful, but increasingly they also display a voice that is far from universal. A voice that is perhaps best described as that of, listen to it now, self-righteous, leftist, feminist-turned-sage. So now we've got self-righteous. Now this is a positive in the book reviews, it'll get a positive. Self-righteous. Feminist. Right? I've lost it. Oh, leftist feminist. Yeah, it's not just feminist. And all of those things, of course, are negative. Later. In keeping with the conventions of propagandist feminist fiction, I think it is feminist fiction. Isn't it? I mean, we all felt that. But it may be more than that. They invariably focus on sympathetically drawn female characters who take it for granted that most Judeo-Christian codes and bourgeois values are inimical to personal growth. Run that one by you again. Most Judeo-Christian codes and bourgeois values are the enemy of personal growth. Indeed, they strongly imply that women belong to a wholly separate, infinitely superior species. In their own way, they are consciously, or consequently, as predictable and tedious as any harlequin romance. The color purple. Seeley's Princess Charming. Now, you're talking about good literature, that isn't how you talk about the main character. Is one Shug Avery, an itinerant blues singer who once lived with Albert. Everybody, should we just go through a little bit of what goes on in the story before I go any further? Just the plot, for those of you who haven't been with it. We meet, as a matter of fact, I'll start. No, I won't either. You start. The plot, which is kind of hard to catch in a way. But it isn't, because you liked it. Seeley is the main character, and what goes on?
Seeley and her sister are separated because the father doesn't want them to have the close bond.
Okay, they've got a dad and a mom, and the dad and Seeley create two kids together. And right away, part of the ugliness of the story. But what do we learn later on?
Child abuse.
Child abuse is sure part of it, for sure. But dad is not her dad. She doesn't know that when she's 14. So what she knows at 14 is that this guy who she thinks is her dad has had her in bed at least twice, and twice impregnated her, and then made her get rid of the kids, and then what happens? They grow up and go off to Africa, and we meet them later. Okay? Nettie goes off to Africa too, right? And then Seeley, what happens to her? She marries, I'll erase Nettie now because that's a sister. She marries, in the novel he's called Mr. until the end when he's finally given a name, and I think that's significant. She marries Mr., excuse me. And what? He has, remember this? Bunch of kids.
Kids.
He already has kids, and they treat her wonderfully?
No.
Yeah, throw rocks at her?
Terrible.
Terrible. And he lives in a house, and what's her role in that, this marriage with Mr.?
Slave.
That's a great word. Slave, you got it. Housekeeper, another great word. How is making love? That's the wrong phrase. How is sex between those two? Remember that phrase?
It's rape.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Yeah.
Do you remember how it's described? How Seeley describes it? It's just like going to the, remember that? Toilet.
Yeah,
she said, that's how much emotion she had, and that's how she describes it. So, rape, but what? That's her role. That's her job. I mean, when I want sex, says Mr., and all this time, what does she call her husband?
Mr.
And she's 14, and we don't know. But he has several kids from an earlier, a first wife, of course. And then along comes Shug Avery. Shug is, at best, irreverent. Right? I mean, she's the one who said, we fuck so much in the open that daddy got discouraged. And that was her language. That's not the exact quote, but... Shug comes along, and who was Shug in the past to Mr. Albert? Do you remember that, anybody?
Girlfriend.
A girlfriend of Albert's. Why didn't they get married? They loved each other. Shug says it now, and Albert says it now, that we should have got married, but they didn't. Remember why? Mister's dad didn't approve of Shug. Because she was a little bit too wild. And wild meant a lot of things. One of those things was that she didn't go to church. Now, remember what Mister does and how he treats his wife. And then he got those values from his father, but his father won't approve the woman he loves because one of the things, she doesn't go to church. Okay, Shug comes back on the scene. Are we with it? Am I doing okay? Okay. Shug's back on the scene, and she kind of lives in the house with Celia and Mister. And where's the first place she sleeps? Yeah. She comes and she drives up with a visit. Oh, hi. Oh, you're Celia. You're his wife, huh? Well, I'm going to sleep with him now for a couple of weeks. And she's kind of sick. What does Celia do? Takes care of her. Nurses her back to good health. And then what happens? And we're almost done. Because we're going to leave out the whole African thing. There is a profound and I think good theme of colonialism in the novel. And how the Dutch have treated the Africans and what's happened to the African society because of it. We won't look at that. We'll look at the theme of redemption. Do you remember? Yes. Shug and Celie have a relationship. Are you willing to say how you felt about that?
It's rather unusual.
Yeah. I mean, right here we've got it's homosexual.
Celie discovers love for the first time.
Yeah. And so I think my mother-in-law, conservative Rockford Republican, I'm kidding when I say, I mean, that's what she...
No, he isn't.
I asked her then specifically too, well, what about that? Well, nobody ever loved her before. That was her response. And judgment about the morality of it was suspended. Now we're coming to that theme. The price of redemption has something to do with the judgment of the characters in the book. And then my English teachers always said, aha, now art has become life, which I never understood. That's what happens to us too. That's what happens to the readers. We suspend judgment. We look past conventional morality and say, but she's never been loved before. So don't we do that? I mean, somehow we don't approve, but maybe. Okay, we'll go on. Shug and Celie have this relationship that doesn't last very long. The sexual part of it doesn't, but there is a relationship too, isn't there, between the two? And
they become good friends.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. They become very, very close friends, supportive. Celie says, I'm going to make sure that Albert doesn't treat you that way anymore. And then Shug and Celie, to end it, what happens? Quickly. Celie finds that she has incredible talents with...
She goes into production.
Yeah, she goes into production, she sews clothes, and she makes pants. And you can, and that's what some critics get off on. Oh, isn't it wonderful? This feminist now makes pants. And then they make that some kind of a symbol of, you know, the woman can finally wear the pants in the house, and then reduce the book to that. Well, it doesn't matter if she makes pants or wedding rings. She's a skilled artist now on her own, and Shug's support helped her make it.
Shug marries someone else.
Yes. And Shug runs off with two different guys, in fact.
Yeah.
And
the means. She gets the money to support it.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Well, we'll go on to our criticism now. You know the story roughly. Throughout The Color Purple, Shug attempts to raise Celie's consciousness by reminding her that while the average man can be trained to become a halfway decent bed partner, he cannot easily cease being a cad. After all, he is a part of a patriarchal system that is malign and omnipotent and bent on staying that way. Man, this is a quote from the novel now, explains Shug, man corrupt everything. He on your box of grits, in your head, and all over the radio. He try to make you think he's everywhere. Now back to the literary critic. In short, he is the boogeyman, as well as Big Brother, and he's at the root of all social injustice and human woe. Now, if I had the notes I prepared, I could go right to the page where Shug says that. And now I'm sorry, I can't. If I can't find it right away, I will skip it and make my point about it without reading it to you. I can't find it right away. What do you make of this, first of all? Man, corrupt everything. He on your box of grits in your head and all over the radio. Now, this isn't mankind. This is the male gender. He try to make you think he everywhere. And then the critic says, he's the boogeyman.
I would count that as an overgeneralization. Isn't there one good man around that you ever met?
How about in this novel? Did you see the movie or the novel? Either one. Is there one good man in there? Anywhere?
Exactly your experience, that there isn't any.
There aren't any good men, and this, you're right, in our society, of course, but in this novel there are no good men. Well, what else would you make of this? I wonder if when Celie says it, now listen to the beginning, first of all, to give you a reason for my interpreting it differently than this guy does. The whole book is a collection of letters, and Celie writes them, most of them, and if she doesn't write them, Nettie, her sister, does. But pretty much the novel is letters from Celie, and that's the format. Here's one letter, it ends there, and here's another letter. But listen to the significance of the letter. It's a very strange way to write a novel, I think. The novel opens. The salutation. Dear God, now that's a clue right away that this book is about something other than feminist rights. It is about that. And we'd be short-sighted if we didn't see that. Dear God, and then the next, if that didn't convince you, the next one will. I am 14 years old. I am, she crosses it out, I have always been a good girl. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me. If you miss the first paragraph, and that's it, we miss the sense of depth that this is about. It's not about, you know, why is he beating me? Though it is. God, what's happening to me? What's my life? What's it becoming? And over again, she asks those kinds of questions. And from some older notes, I do have those pages. Yay. Just to... God, G-O-D-, she ends her letter. You got to fight them. She's talking about men oppressing her now, too. And her now it's her father and Mr., her husband. And she's had a discussion with a woman who marries one of Mr.'s kids. In the movie, that's the part that Oprah Winfrey played. And her name is Sophia. Sophia had been talking to her. You got to fight them, Celie, she said. I can't do it for you. You got to fight them for yourself. I don't say nothing. I think about Nettie dead. At this point, she thinks her sister, Nettie, is dead, when in fact she's in Africa. She doesn't know that. I don't say nothing. I think about Nettie dead. She fight. She run away. What good it do? I don't fight. I stay where I'm told. But I'm alive. Man is everywhere. He's on your box of grits. It has something to do with mankind, if we can use that word, or humankind, to make it more generic, has imposed a whole set of values and a certain kind of vision about how to see the world. And it is everywhere, isn't it? This is how the world is seen. And in her world, in this book, her world is men are the boss, women are the slave, they are sex objects, they are housekeepers, and that's all they are. And in this narrow world with its narrow vision, there's no possibility to experience the self until we get out of it. But in this early in the novel, what good it do, says the 14-year-old. I don't fight. I stay where I'm told. But I'm alive. One of the themes that is present in, I would say, every piece of American black literature that I've read is this theme. If you choose to survive physically, you die spiritually. If you choose to live spiritually, historically, not in the modern times, though, so much, you die physically. Frederick Douglass' slave narrative has a wonderful illustration of the slave who fought his boss, his master, and then ran to the river and wouldn't come out. He lived. He fought. And the master just stood on his shore and three shots right in his head. True story. The choice between physical and spiritual survival is a theme that runs throughout American black literature. It's a powerful theme here too. And that physical survival sometimes is all a character has time for. There's no time, I mean, dear God, maybe you can tell me what's happening to me. I don't say nothing, I don't fight, I can't think. Well, later on. I'm done here and you're going to discuss it in not too long. I don't know how to fight. All I know how to do is stay alive. And then she's had a discussion. All women's not alike, Tobias, she say, believe it or not. Oh, I believe it, he say, just can't prove it to the world. And Celia interjects in this letter. First time I think about the world. You with her? This conscience growing and consciousness growing little girl becoming aware of who she is in this society that for now sees the world this way. And we're going to come as readers and see it other than that so that the characters here can break out and find themselves. Well, the critic goes on. Celie finally gives up on Albert and moves to Memphis, where, with Shug's help, she metamorphoses into an eminent designer of women's trousers. She does. And metamorphosis is kind of a, you know, put-down word, you know, grand, big change. Come on, look at this, how great this is. After hearing the gospel according to Shug, she gives up Christianity, too. For God, proclaims Shug, can rarely be found in church. And never in the white folks' white Bible. That's all quote out of the book. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. And it is remarkably laid back. This is the critic now talking. It could care less about, say, the seven deadly sins. It just wants everybody to sniff the flowers and listen to the birdies sing. It wants everybody to have a good time with everybody. As the hedonistic Shug puts it while woman-handling Celie, you can just relax, go with everything that's going, and praise God by liking what you like. And the critic then says, so much then for succinct, profound discussions about the existence of God. What I'd like to put on the board, and we'll go back to the novel with, is this phrase. The gospel according to Shug and God ain't a he, he, she, but it's an it. And finally, God is not in a church. A listened to Shug say these things. And I, again, my apologies for not having these pages right at hand. Any other book? Did anyone know what page you're on? If I did this at Augustana, I would give the dean permission to fire me.
You'd call him sick first.
Huh?
You'd call him sick first.
Well, I made all these attempts to...
Could I say something while you're...
You sure can, thank you.
...for the sake of the tape? I think to say that this is a feminist fiction type novel is to miss the... Although that is one theme, you're missing the whole... Well, a person would be missing the whole point of that book. It's a poor, southern, black culture, which is not unlike the poor, southern, white culture. A culture that northern people never saw, and that white people, on the whole, never saw as far as the blacks were, or the poor southern whites were concerned. And I think it's to teach us a little bit about some of our roots that we don't or haven't wanted to face up to in the past.
Well, how does that's very good. How does the book appeal to so many people? Then, if we don't want to face up to this, are we suddenly willing?
I think we're getting educated enough that we can. For instance, my daughter on our honeymoon went to England, and she saw Alice Walker's books all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Not like we see in our bookstores, but all of her books. She is really a very popular writer as far as England is concerned. Long before we saw her as a gifted writer here in the United States. And we're just beginning to say, hey, maybe we can learn a little bit from our past. I think. Does that sound too far off?
No. I think that sounds like good reading, and that's...
And can I defend the pants, too?
Please.
Well, you know, in the South, women just didn't wear pants. All they wore were dresses. And this was a new Yankee style that hadn't come to
sure.
their part of their culture and anything. And I think it was a marvelous thing that they could, you know, make this little business, make something available that wasn't available in the South to the poor blacks as well as poor whites.
Absolutely.
And help them to feel like, you know, they were a part of what society was doing.
Absolutely. The pants are outside, aren't they? This normal vision of what the world is supposed to be and what the society is supposed to be. Here's the Gospel of Shug. Dear Nettie, I don't write to God no more. I write to you. What happened to God? Asked Shug. And now, Nettie, just to give you the sense of the format here. Seeley says everybody's lines. Okay? So if I'm going to tell you what she said, I'm going to say, well, Jeannie then said, and then Bob said, so that's all in this. Okay? Okay. You're Nettie. I don't write to God no more. I write to you. What happened to God? Asked Shug. Who that? I say. She look at me serious. Big a devil as you is, I say, you're not worried about no God, surely. She say, wait a minute. Hold on just a minute here. Just because I don't harass it like some people's us know don't mean I ain't got no religion. What God do for me, I asked. She say, Seeley. Like she shocked. He gave you life, good health, and a good woman that love you to death. Yeah, I say. And he gave me a lynch daddy, a crazy mama, a low-down dog of a step-pa, and a sister I probably won't ever see again. Anyhow, I say, the God I've been praying and writing to is a man, and act just like all other men's I know, trifling, forgetful, and low down. Where does she get her idea? I mean, it's on one level, and this is a simple question, but take it further. Where does she get her idea of God?
Men she knew.
Sure. Men she knew, but also just I mean, all the men, but the convention of society has suggested, so it's bigger than just the men in this book. She's saying, Miss Seeley, you better hush. God might hear you. Let him hear me, I say. If he ever listened to poor colored women, the world would be a different place, I can tell you. She talked and she talked, trying to budge me away from my blasphemy, but I blaspheme much as I want to. All my life, I never care what people... Now, Sugar's talking. All my life, I never care what people thought about nothing I did, I say. Seeley stuff. But deep in my heart, I care about God. What are you going to think? And come to find out, he don't think. Just sit up there glorifying and being deef. But it ain't easy trying to do without God. Some of you were at the Barabbas discussion. Barabbas' painful, tragic journey is trying to do without God. This book is more than about pants. But it ain't easy trying to do without God, even if you know he ain't there. Trying to do without him is a strain. I is a sinner, says Shug, because I was born. I don't deny it. But once you find out what's out there waiting for us, what else can you be? And I read that and I'm reminded of this. Jesus, in the Sermon on, is it the Sermon on the Mount? Where is it that he says, tell me, Pastor. The law says that you shall not commit adultery.
Yes.
Right, yeah, right. But I say, every one of you has committed adultery. Who is, the law says you shall not kill, but I say every one of you who has hated his brother has killed his brother. It's almost as if, I mean, sometimes I read it this way. I see that when I hear the whole story read together, I read it that way even more clearly. Jesus is saying, okay, you can stone the harlot, you can do all, and the adulteress and all these things, but come on, man, get on with it. You got to live, and nobody's any better than anybody else. And Shug's gospel here isn't so far off, is it? But once you find out what's out there waiting for us, what else can you be but a sinner? Sinners have more good times, I say. You know why, she asked? Because you ain't all the time worrying about God, I say. Nah, that ain't it, she say. Us worry about God a lot. She's included herself as a sinner now. But once us feel loved by God, us do the best us can to please him with what us like. I'll read that again with the normal kind of pronouns. Seeley uses the us because she's uneducated. Now that ain't it, she say. We worry about God a lot. But once we feel loved by God, we do the best we can to please him with what we're like. You telling me, says Seeley, God love you and you ain't never done nothing for him? I mean, listen to these. I circled them in my book. Not go to church, sing in the choir, and feed the preacher? And all like that? But if God loved me, Seeley, I don't have to do all that. Unless I want to. There's a lot of other things I can do that I expect God likes. Like what? I asked. Oh, she say, I can lay back and just admire stuff. Be happy. Have a good time. Well, this sounds like blasphemy sure enough. She say, Seeley, tell the truth. Have you ever found God in church? I never did. I just found a bunch of folks hoping for him to show. Any God I ever felt in church, I brought in with me. Remind you of J.D. Salinger? We're all too stupid and unimaginative to know that the kingdom of God is right inside us. And I think all the other folks did too. They come to church to share God, not find God. Now, how far off is that, folks?
Carl Bart would have much trouble with any of that.
Well, I'm not a Carl Bart expert, but I appreciate hearing that. Yes. Some folks didn't have them to share, I said. They ones didn't speak to me while I was there struggling with my big belly and Mr.'s children. Another incident that happens here is that Mr. has a son. His name is Harpo. And Harpo falls in love with Sophia, the Oprah Winfrey of the movie. And Sophia comes over and she's pregnant. She says, Harpo and I are going to get married. You in trouble? She says, Nope, no trouble. Big, though. And I'm reminded I can share an anecdotal personal experience. When a junior on our track team, who was one of the, I call them kids because I'm 40 now, I can do that. One of the kids I love the most, which is all of them, I guess. And for a week and a half, he's, and I'll make it short. He's depressed, and all of a sudden, Coach, I got to talk to you. I have to get married. Well, fortunately, somebody else clued me in on this problem, as we call it, ahead of time. And I said, well, do you love her? Oh, yeah. Does she love you? Oh, yeah. Well, what do you mean you have to get married? And I'm not condoning, and I'm not even making any judgment at all. I'm suggesting what I tried to give to him, and I got the idea from The Color Purple and Sophia's Nope, No Trouble, Big Bill. From the idea that you don't have to begin your marriage through the conventional eyes of conventional morality if you want to make it work and you want to go into it without a whole load of guilt and so on. Well, again, we suspend judgment on that particular anecdote, but we suspend the judgment on this novel too. As we, yeah, well, Sophia, okay, there's love. And we're going to have to look outside of this normal moral code for a moment and see what's going on. Harpo, in that relationship, I'll tell you ahead of time, can't ever look beyond it. And he has to control his wife just like his daddy did, and when he can't, he tries to. He tries to hit her, and what does she do? Remember? She beats him up. I mean, she's big. You can just see it in the movie. She pounds him up. Okay. And he comes to Celia and says, what do? I can't control my woman. And Celia says, have you hit her yet? He says, yeah, I tried that. And about 5 weeks later, he comes back to Celia. And Celia says, Harpo, she loves to work in the field. You love to cook in the house. You got a woman that loves you. But, and he interrupts her. You know what she's going to say. You got a woman that loves you. You love her. Get out and let her out in the field. He interrupts her and says, but that's a man's work. That's the feminist part. But it's more than that. It has to do with the vision of the conventional ways to see the world. And if we buy into that, the conventional ways to see the world is, for all of us in this room, in our educations, is white male history and the way it's been perceived. Well, we're back to her gospel still. I read that some folks didn't have time to share God. They were the ones that didn't speak to me while I was there struggling with my big belly and Mister's children. Right, she say. Then she say, tell me what your God looked like, Celie. No, I say, I'm too ashamed. Nobody ever asked me this before, so I'm sort of took by surprise. Besides, when I think about it, it don't seem quite right. But all I got. I decide to stick up for him, just to see what Shug say. Okay, I say. He big and old and tall and gray-bearded and white. He wear white robes and go barefooted. Blue eyes? She asked. Sort of bluish-gray, cool, big, white, big though. White lashes, I say. She laugh. Why you laugh, I asked. I don't think it's so funny. What do you expect him to look like, mister? That wouldn't be no improvement, she said. Then she tell me this old white man is the same God she used to see when she prayed. Used to see when she prayed. Somehow it echoes some of Jesus' talk, too. If you wait to find God in church, Celie say, that's who was bound to show up, because that's where he live, this white God that you... How come, I asked, because that's the one that's in the white folks' white Bible. Shug, I say, God wrote the Bible. White folks had nothing to do with it. How come he looked just like them then, she say, only bigger and a heap more hair? How come the Bible, just like everything else they make, all about them doing one thing and another and all the colored folks doing is getting cursed? You ever thought about that? And the way that's been historically, traditionally interpreted for us. Cain, curse of Ham, I never thought about that. Nettie say somewhere in the Bible it say Jesus' hair was like lamb's wool, I say. Well, say Shug, if he'd come to any of these churches we talking about, he'd have to have it comped before anybody'd pay him any attention. The last things blacks want to think about their God is that they have kinky hair. That's the truth, I say. Ain't no way to read the Bible and not think God white, she say. Then she sigh. When I found out, now, is that true? It is in this traditional way to view the Bible. But what Alice Walker is after is see the world, one thing. See our society, one thing. See God, bigger. Remember that quote from Lagerfist? God, he's got quotes around it in the small g, is what divides us from the divine. And what he means by God, in quotes, is men and women's limitations and definitions of God. Ain't no way to read the Bible and not think God white, she say. Then she saw it. When I found out I thought God was white and a man, I lost interest. You mad because he don't seem to listen to your prayers. Here's the thing, says Sugar, and then I'm done. Now. The thing I believe, God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. Now her pronoun is it. And sometimes it just manifests itself even if you're not looking or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble do it for most folks, I think. Sorrow. Sorrow, Lord, or feeling like shit. It? I asked. Yeah, it. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. She asks about sex. God made it. Listen, God love everything you love and a mess of stuff you don't. But more than anything else, God love admiration. You saying God vain, I asked? Nah, she say, not vain, just wanting to share a good thing. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. Well, the language is different, but the idea is something deeper. So much then for succinct, profound discussions about the existence of God. We've got 5 minutes. What? I'm sorry, it's tough to cover a novel. Respond from what you've heard and what you can imagine about vision. About homosexual relationships. About sex anywhere, anytime, the way it appears often in this book. Is Alice Walker after all that? Go ahead.
You don't have to answer. I think it helps us to redefine in our mind what is true love? You know, what is love really about? Mm-hmm.
Good. And the book is after that. I think we want to be sure we don't get mixed up with themes and vehicles. Vehicles are those things that carry the themes. And one of the vehicles that carries her theme of, you pointed it out, what is love really all about is, she portrays a homosexual relationship. Not to lift up homosexuality, nor to suppress it, but simply to say, is there another way to look at love? Not to condemn the church, does she? I don't think so. If you read the whole book, and I encourage you to do it, but to think another way about God. We hear that every Sunday, you know, come to church, is that all there is to it? That's a good observation. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. I think when I read this, one thing that really touched me was the portrayal of real human sensitivity and feelings that are in Seeley and some of the other characters among people whom we would tend to perhaps almost write off as being backward, ignorant, black,
yes,
southern, poor, with a lifestyle that's totally without any kind of structure or sanity or anything to it.
Would you say animals?
What I mean is that people in this kind of cultural mess and chaos are still human beings with very sensitive human feelings. And so the people in that book, I think, come across as deeply feeling human beings, even though their behavior may not be what we would think maybe ought to be.
Good. really good. And an important thing to sense with this too about the male characters is simply this idea that the men in here who get such bad roles, and a lot of black people, black critics criticize that in the movie, these men are victims of an oppressive society. And that's part of what they've learned too, you know, and how to handle people.
They knew no other way.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And yeah, good.
And there is something that happens to Albert in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to find it before we go. We got 2 minutes on my watch. I saw him way in the back, didn't I?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think the beauty of this book for me was in the love and acceptance of one another, and not just that each of us is to be valued by another individual for our lifetime, and the immense value that it supports us in the universe.
Yes.
Family, if you will.
Good. Judgment, and that's where art becomes life. You did it too as you read. But judgment by these characters and how they judge each other, their goodness is based on something other than conventional morality. It's based on, are they good to you? Do they love you? In the end of the book, I'll just quickly share with you, Albert and Celie are out under the stars. Albert and Celie, and they're just having a hug. Just no sex, just a hug. And Celie says, here us is, two old fools left over from love. But the redemption comes when Albert is able to be called Albert and recognizes his son's love for him and vice versa, and then the reconciliation occurs in their marriage, Sophia's and what's his name? Harper's, yeah, Albert's son. And the reconciliation happens here. Not reconciliation like the marriage is back together, a reconciliation that's better than that even. It's a deep kind of respect and love. And Albert finally sits down, and one of the great scenes is, what does he do with Celie? They sew together. And you learn at the end of the book that he wanted to sew when he was little, but he never dared. His dad wouldn't let him, and that's women's work. His vision is bigger. And his vision about the society and feminist and as versus masculine acts is bigger, so is his vision bigger about God.
Uh-huh. So Albert wasn't all bad.
At the end, absolutely not. But you paint this through and he's pretty bad at the beginning, yes.
I think you're being kicked out.
Come on in. Thank you, gang.